thought.
Well, my dear, you soon know more about the heathens of old than we Abyssinese do. But there are books that say that the pharaohs of Khem ruled with soul-eating magics from their gods.
Rashid, who had been long silent, narrowed his tilted eyes. He drew his sword and began to clean it.
With apologies, books and history are not our concern. This creature Mau'awa is murdering men and women. Worse, if the doctor speaks true, it keeps their souls from God's presence. It, and whoever set it to killing, must be found and slain now.
The way the dervish stood and spoke made Zamia want to be nearer to him. Was she not lying down, she feared she would have taken a step toward him against her will.
So how can we hope to kill this foul thing?
Rashid continued.
My sword made no mark on it. My boldest blade strokes did nothing.
Dawood's brow furrowed in thought. He pulled at his headed goatee.
I am not surprised by that, he said. This Mau'awa was apparently born of ancient Khem magics. Twisted spells that your steel and even my own powers and Adula's invocations could well be useless against. What say you, beloved?
Dawood turned to his wife, not looking hopeful. The alchemist shook her head, her hair rings clinking.
Given God's help and months of study, perhaps I could try and devise some substance to fight such a thing. But we don't have months.
Zamia found herself speaking the words almost before she thought them.
It fled from my claws. I wounded it badly. Sen says I am the only one who can kill it.
She was very aware of what her next words were, and speaking them filled her with nausea.
Except that I am myself wounded and half dead, and I cannot take the shape.
Lita sniffed at her.
Don't insult our craft, child. You're not half dead. The way you heal, you'll be back on your feet in a couple of days.
Zamia turned her head and found the doctor looking at her so hard that she felt certain he could see through her.
Indeed, the ghoul hunter said, and may it please God that it be so. Or the child may be right about her claws.
He stopped staring at her, and seemed now to stare hard at nothing.
Do you know I've read translated accounts by barbarian priests in the warlands? The land of Braxany was once tormented by creatures, half wolf, half man. The heroes of that land were able to slay the monsters with silver swords, swords that they claimed were touched by angels, as I recall. Of course, those were just books and histories, and thus not our concern, he said, sparing a droll look for Rashid.
Rashid made a noise in his throat.
The angels would never visit blessings on those heathenish lands. Their favors are not for thieves and blasphemers.
He fell silent and looked at the floor. For the first time since she'd met him, Zamia scented something impure wafting from the dervish's body. Something almost like deception. Impossible, she told herself. Perhaps her senses had been a bit confounded by injury and healing drugs. The doctor shrugged his big shoulders at his assistant.
I don't know about that. But this is similar to what your people say of the lion shape, is it not, Zamia? When you told me you carry no weapon, what was that bombastic bit of verse you spoke?
It disturbed Zamia that she was growing so used to the doctor's insults to her people that she had begun ignoring them.
I am a Bedouin, not a timid townsman. Bombast is not an insult to a true tribesman.
Fine, fine. The saying, child, what is it?
My claws, my fangs, the silver knives with which the ministering angels strike.
Then, without warning, she felt tears begin to well up in her eyes. She wiped them away.
I am the only one who can avenge the Binu Laith Bedouin, and I cannot take the shape.
You will avenge your band, Zamia, rest easy in that,
the doctor said, and Zamia thanked God for the confidence in his eyes and scent. The ghoul hunter went on, his voice growing softer.
Child, you should know. That is, well, your pain is the freshest here, Zamia, but it is not unique. God's truth be told, girl. We're a veritable orphan hall here. The boy's kin left all claim to him behind at the gates of the Lodge of God. My friends are 1,000 miles and 20 years away from anyone they call family, and they've lost.
The doctor stopped himself from saying something.
They've lost much more than you could know to this half-secret war we fight against the traitorous angel.
Zamia looked over at Litas. The alchemist's normally warm smile was nowhere to be seen. She gave Ardula a sad look and stood up. In her small, blue-black hands she held Zamia's father's dagger. Zamia reached out weakly, wanting to hold the weapon in her own hands.
"That dagger! My bands!"
she started to say.
"Don't worry,"
Litas said.
"I will return it. But thanks to Rasid, we now have a solution that will distill the strange blood that blackens it to an analyzable essence. It will take me a little while to prepare it, though."
The alchemist darted another look at the doctor, irritated rather than sad.
"Ardula, since you are so set on sharing secret pains today, maybe you should speak to the girl about your own family."
She left the room. Dawood followed her out, throwing the doctor an apologetic glance as he did so.
"And what, doctor, was that about?"
Zamia asked.
"Ask Litas sometime and she will tell you, child. She is right, though, that I owe you a bit of my own story, for there should be a balance between allies in what we know of each other's pain."
Rasid, looking disgusted with himself and still smelling atypically of deception, stepped out of the room, giving her and the doctor a bit of privacy. She watched the dervish go, puzzled, then forced her attention back to the ghoul hunter.
"Litas mentioned your family," she said.
"Aye. She means my parents, really. I only have the dimmest memories of them alive. Mostly I recall finding their bodies. As a boy, I told myself stories about them every day. They were killed because they were really a caliph and queen in disguise, and I, like a story hero, was a secret prince. But they weren't royalty,"
the doctor went on.
"They were a porter and his wife, ordinary people of the scholar's quarter, who left me, through no choice of their own, to a cruel fate with no kin and no money."
The doctor paused to fetch Zamia a clay cup of cool water. She took a long drink from it, felt the sweet pain of her parched throat coming to life again. She didn't know what to say to the doctor's words.
"How did they die?"
she asked, realizing too late that to these two subtle city men, such a question might be taken as rude. But the doctor only sighed.
"Ah, pointlessly, my dear. They died pointlessly. No grand prophecy, no dark mission of the servants of the traitorous angel. Just a pathetic, desperate piece of shit with a knife, who was drunk or stupid enough to think he could somehow get a few coins out of my completely coinless father."
Vacantly, the ghoul hunter plucked up a bit of brown cloth from a Sioux sewing tray sitting on the cushion beside him. As he spoke, he began to twist the cloth in his hands, apparently unaware of what he was doing.
"When I was barely a man, I managed to track their killer down. He had ended up a one-legged gutter sitter, obliterated by wormwood wine. I had started to study my craft then, but in truth I was still the street tough that had led the other young troublemakers of Dead Donkey Lane. But when I found that man, I was more vicious than I'd ever been in any brawl. I killed him with a knife, stabbed him 10 times. It takes a man a long time to die from a short-bladed knife, long enough for me to wake from my rage, long enough to find myself holding a bloody blade, hovering over the body of a still-begging cripple."
The doctor shook himself.
"I still can't explain what I felt at that moment. But you and I have more than one thing in common. To this day, I keep my hand free of the feel of killing steel. I've seen enough knives and swords. Now, instead of killing, I do all that I can to keep men from dying.
When we met, I wondered why you were traveling on such dangerous errands unarmed.
I am not a soft man, Zamia. I travel with those willing to kill. I flatter myself that I can still throw a punch as good as any man half my age. But, well, there is a difference between cold-blooded guttings and giving a cruel man a bloody nose once in a rare while.
Dawood appeared in the doorway and snorted.
Once in a rare while! Do not let him fool you, girl. Adula Maxlud has handed out cracked ribs and swollen skulls a good bit more often than once in a rare while.
The Magus walked over and patted the ghoul hunter on his shoulder.
This one's as much a savage as any Bedouin, make no mistake.
Zamia was about to take the Magus to task for thus characterizing her people, but a sudden stink, so strong that to Zamia's keen senses it was almost a physical object, filled the room. At first she was sure one of the old men had broken wind. They kept pointing accusing fingers at each other and snickering like children. But it was a different sort of stink, a scent her senses didn't recognize, and it was streaming in from the small shop cedar windows.
"What is that smell?"
she asked, gagging around the words. The doctor stopped snickering, and as he spoke his voice dripped with disdain.
"That is the smell of the dyers and the tanners. The new caliph, in his infinite wisdom, had the wafting spells reroute the stink through the scholars' quarter last year. Now one evening each week that damned by God smell gets dumped upon us and lingers for an hour. Were it any more than that, I swear to you the caliph would have a riot on his hands."
Dawood grumbled something, walked over to a large knit pouch that hung on the wall, and produced from it two pieces of folded cloth. He handed them to Zamia and the doctor.
"Sad to say, I'm almost growing used to it. But Litas has taken to keeping these around."
"Praise God for your wife's wisdom, brother of mine."
The doctor held the cloth over his mouth and nose. As Zamia followed suit, she was surprised by the pungent but pleasant smells of mint oil and cinnamon, and under these, the stinging scent of vinegar. The Magus's eyes tightened, and his voice grew firm.
"I won't let her be hurt," he said.
He spoke to the doctor as if Zamia were not right there.
"We are with you, my old friend, you know that. But this isn't like the old days. I will not let Litas be hurt. Now it is that before anything else."
Zamia felt words rising up within her, but she kept them down. The doctor set down his scented cloth. He put a big brown hand on his friend's shoulder.
"I will not let her be hurt either, brother of mine."
Zamia believed him. In that moment the doctor seemed frighteningly alert to her. His face looked less round somehow, hard and haggard. She wished her will alone could heal her wounds and return her powers. To be lying in a sick bed while brave old men— yes, Dr. Adula Maxlud was brave, Zamia had to confess it— did the work of avenging her tribe. It twisted her stomach. Zamia vomited over the edge of the divan. Thin yellow bile splashed onto the doctor's caftan, then slid away. Zamia was mortified. Her stomach twisted into further knots from pain and drugs, stink and embarrassment, and the taste of bile. She vomited again, this time at least finding the copper pail Litas had placed beside the couch. At that moment the alchemist swept into the room and began shooing out the men.
"Out, you two, out! This child is a chieftain's daughter, and she has just emptied her guts before you. Do you think she needs two old goats hovering over her? No, leave this between us women of high station. I said go. Name of God, can you men not make yourselves useful elsewhere?"
Zamia was as thankful for the alchemist's presence as for any rescue by an armed ally. She felt better now that her stomach was empty, and when the men had left, she smiled weakly at Litas. But the little woman looked heartbroken as she sat beside Zamia.
"Do you know only a day ago I was dreading the drudgery of drawing up accounts after I'd stay? I thought that was going to be the great pain of my week. Now I have a household of pain and loss.
Shame flooded Zamia's heart.
I am sorry, Auntie, to have brought my troubles to your door.
Litaz waved away the words.
I'm not speaking only of you. Adula Maxlud lost a lifetime's worth of books and talismans in that fire, Zamia. He is doing things only a young man should do in order to rearm himself. Sleep-stealing spells, self-bleedings and such. We fought side by side for many years, dear, and I'm not sure I've ever seen him more determined.
Zamia found comfort in this. She felt her respect for Dr. Adula Maxlud deepen almost physically. Litaz continued as she cleaned up the mess Zamia had made.
You must understand what he has lost, Zamia. That townhouse, it was a sign of something. A sign that this man without wife or child or high station held something in this world.
The alchemist shook her head.
But I suppose these things would make little sense to a tribeswoman, especially to one as young as you. With my father against my band, with my band against my tribe, with my tribe against the world. You think us all quite strange, this little family of not blood, do you not?
Zamia thought for a moment before speaking.
Strange. Perhaps, but also admirable. So different from one another, yet so dedicated to each other. God's truth be told, I've never seen such a way of being before. My own band feared me, even as they were happy enough to call me protector.
She stopped herself before saying any more. How dare she speak ill of her band, her dead band, to this woman who was practically a stranger? She changed the subject.
You and your husband, Auntie, you have been married to him a long time, yes? And you sleep with him despite his tainted powers?
Only after she'd spoken did she realize that, to a townsman, this was inappropriate talk. But Litaz just laughed.
Ha! Do you think he's grown hooves or something? He has all the same elements that make a man. We may not be the hot-blooded couple we once were, but yes, of course I sleep with him. And yet you two have no children.
Litaz smiled a small, sad smile, and said nothing.
Forgive me, Auntie, I should not have... No, no, there's no need for forgiveness, child. We had a son, Dawood and I. It was a long, long time ago. He was a beautiful boy, and in his beaming little face was everything that was handsome of the Red River Sioux and the Blue.
The air was thick with the sadness in the woman's words.
He has gone to join God, Auntie.
A tiny, graceful nod.
Yes. 20 years dead. He would be older than you had he lived.
She looked at Zamia as if trying to decide how to say something.
Dawood and I were taught hard lessons when we were young, Zamia Binulaith Bedui. Lessons about the wrath of the traitorous angel, and about vulnerabilities.
For a few long moments, the alchemist seemed to stare at something far away.
Well,
Litaz finally said, standing up.
My scrying solution should be boiling by now. I must attend to them. You should eat something and sleep a bit more, and take this tea, which will complete your healing.
The alchemist fed her pocket bread filled with chickpeas and olive oil, then gave her a too sweet medicinal tea. Zamia had barely set down the cup before her eyelids began to droop, and she slid into a dreamless sleep. She half woke several times from her feverish healing sleep. Each time she caught the doctor's scent, awake and active. More than once she looked around and saw him there in the sitting room, pounding out some herb or filing some metal into a vial, mumbling some invocation as he did so. Once she saw him slash his own forearm and drip blood onto a piece of vellum. Litaz's words about the doctor's determination floated through her head as Zamia drifted in and out of sleep. When she finally, truly woke, she was alone. The wound in her side still ached painfully, but the nausea was gone, and she felt a renewed strength in her limbs. It was hard to tell time by the city's sun and moonlight, buildings warped it in weird ways. But from the dark outside the windows, Zamiya guessed that it was very late at night. Again she tried to take the shape, and again she felt as if she were trying to breathe sand. She stifled her tears, though, and shakily brought herself to her feet. From another room she heard voices, the doctor's, Litas's, Daoud's. Zamiya's steps were slow and awkward. She followed the sound of the voices to the room adjoining the sitting room. The room was crowded with things and people. A shelf of books, racks of bottles, and strange tubes made of glass. The only relatively clear surface was a large table made of some strange metal. The doctor's white caftaned bulk was perched on a low stool, and Rashid leaned against the wall beside him. Litas sat in a tall chair before this table, her husband hovering over her shoulder, both of them looking at a massive wood-bound book that lay open there. Beside the book was a bizarre brass and glass apparatus. One part of the thing looked like a small claw, and Zamiya saw that this claw clutched her father's knife. Litas was looking into another part of the device, shaped like a huge eye, and evidently comparing what she saw to the figures and words in the book. Study, the memorization of plants, the intricacies of the stars. For years, her father had tried to teach her that these were a part of being protector of the band.
"Patience, little moon, is a warrior's virtue," he would say. "Your strength alone is not enough. You must have knowledge, too, little rose, and judgment. And as I say, little emerald, patience."
Though she was always protector when there were others to overhear, in private her father had perhaps a dozen little nicknames for her. She loved the way he'd peppered his speech with them, even as he had raised her to be a warrior. Her father's greatest worry had been that Zamiya was too lion-like.
"You do well to spend more time learning the townsman's letters, and less time stalking sand foxes. There are many ways in which the protector must defend the band,"
he'd said just a fortnight ago, looking so disappointed that it hurt Zamiya inside. Just to make her father happy, she had tried to pay attention to the book full of meaningless marks as he tried to teach them to her. Had tried hard, but try as she might, she was not made for such things. Her new allies all looked up as they heard her approach. Rashid stopped leaning on the wall and took a step toward her before he seemed to stop himself. The doctor's eyes were wide, perhaps surprised that she was on her feet. Litas looked at her with the same puzzled face that she'd worn when looking through that glass eye. The old Magus, though, was the first to speak.
"Name of God, child, you should be resting. How is it that you're on your feet? God's balls, how is it that you're awake? You should be heel-sleeping for another 2 or 3 days."
Litas bit her lip, looking as if she were still puzzling something out.
"The touch of the angels," the alchemist said. "Amazing. Clearly the power God's ministers granted you goes beyond your lion shape. Even with our healing magics helping, you should not have been able to walk for a week."
Zamiya raised her chin just a bit.
"Perhaps we savages are more resilient than the soft townsmen you are used to treating, auntie."
The doctor made a farting noise with his mouth and laughed.
"Yes, yes, surely it is the innate bravery of the Bedouin at work here, girl."
Before Zamiya could respond, Rashid was at her side.
"God's mercy is greater than any cruelty,"
he quoted from the heavenly chapters.
"You were grievously wounded, Zamiya. Praise God that you are recovering swiftly, but still you ought to be resting now, for—"
Litas made an irked noise.
"Ah, please," she said to Rashid, "don't give advice when you know not of what you speak. The best thing for Zamiya now is not to sleep. The crimson quicksilver is reawakening her blood, just as it is the blood on this knife. If she can walk, let her. And speaking of blood, she has a right to see whatever answers we may glean here."
The Sioux woman turned to Zamiya and gestured to the only other stool in the room.
"Sit. I was just making the final adjustments to my scrying solution. I was asking the men, but you know better than they. When you wounded this Mau'awa creature, did it bleed?"
Zamia forced herself to think of those few moments that had nearly killed her, of her fangs digging into that monster's foul flank. It had been both like and unlike tearing into flesh. There was shadow and pain, but...
No, Auntie. No, it did not bleed.
As I told you, the doctor said, stroking his beard in thought. The girl also said that to her remarkable senses, the blood on this knife smelled of neither man nor animal, whereas this Mau'awa smelled of both. As I'd suspected, this must be the blood of the one who made those ghouls, the one whom that monster called Blessed Friend.
Well, whatever its source, it is the strangest blood I have ever seen, full of life and lifeless. All of the eight elements are here, but they are negated somehow. Sand and lightning, water and wind, wood and metal, orange fire and blue fire. How could they all be in one drop of blood, and yet not be there?
The little woman turned to her husband.
Stranger still, within the clots there are creeping things moving about. It is as if this blood came from some mix of man and ghoul. It makes no sense. Still, my love, you should work your magics here. God willing, they may give us better answers.
Using a tiny silver spoon, the alchemist scooped a bit of white powder from a jar into a glass vial filled with red liquid. The liquid began to bubble and froth, and turned bright green. Litaz then took this liquid and poured it over the bloodied knife that had been Zamia's father's. A bright green light began to shimmer off of the knife. The light grew brighter and brighter until it filled the room.
You can begin,
the Sioux woman said to her husband.
Stand back,
she said to the others, doing so herself as she spoke. The Magus stepped forward, placing his gnarled hands a hair's breadth above the knife. An eerie green light began to glimmer about his fingers as they weaved back and forth around the blood-stained blade. The old Sioux's eyes rolled back, and he chanted a wordless chant in an oddly echoed voice. Wicked magics, Zamia thought. Instinctively, she started to take the shape, and of course found that she couldn't. Panic rose in her again. She could feel the shape just beyond her reach, and feel the pain of her wound keeping her from her lion self.
Almighty God, I beg you, help me!
But then the Magus was speaking, and she had to heed his words, for that was the path to vengeance for the Benu Laith Bedawi. Tears burned in her eyes, but again she shoved thoughts of the shape aside and listened.
This blood is like the cancellation of life,
Dawood said as his long, dark fingers darted back and forth above her father's knife.
More than that,
the cancellation of existence, like the essence of a ghoul, whose false soul is made of creeping things, but with will. Cruel, powerful will.
The doctor spoke quietly to Litaz, as if Zami and Rasid were not there.
This all makes a horrible sort of sense when I think on it. There's an old tale of a man called the Ghoul of Ghouls, a man who was like a ghoul, raised by the traitorous angel himself. A man who'd cut out his own tongue to better let the traitorous angel speak through him, who had his soul emptied, then filled with the will of the traitorous angel. He is supposed to wear a kaftan that can never be clean, and...
The doctor fell silent, as Dawood's head tilted back, and the Magus grimaced as if in great pain. The old Sioux was touching the knife now with his fingertips, and he screamed. It was a wordless screaming chant at first, but the pain-laced sounds resolved into words.
The blood of Oshado! The blood of Oshado!
The Magus's body jerked about strangely as he screamed, but he kept his hands on the knife.
The blood of Oshado!
Litaz leapt up and pried her husband's fingers from the blade. Dawood stumbled into the corner and collapsed onto a cushion with a pitiful moan. He held his head in his hands and sat there, shuddering. The doctor wore worry for his friend on his face.
Your magic takes its toll on your body. For that, brother of mine, the world owes you.
He clasped a hand on the Magus's shoulder.
But magic can also take its toll on the mind. Praise be to God that the girl's would-be assassin was unhinged enough to rattle on so. Clearly this Orshadow is the one who that monster called Blessed Friend. I've long said that my order was misnamed, for in reality it is men, not ghouls, that I hunt. And now we have a quarry. With a tracking spell and a name, we— The doctor's eyes flashed, almost as if he would cry, Zamia thought. I've forgotten, he said softly. I've no scripture engraved needles. They were ruined in that fire like everything else. Soiled beyond use, if not destroyed.
Zamia wanted to insist that there must be another way, but she found that gathering her thoughts and words was an effort. She was weaker than she had admitted to the others. Her heart swelled when Rashid seemed to speak her thoughts for her.
Are there no other spells you might work, Doctor? Is there nowhere else you might buy such needles?
The doctor shook his head.
It's more complicated than that, boy. Those needles take weeks to make. If we were in a remote location or facing a novice magus, I might try a cruder invocation. But the city is full of life energy that will confuse a tracking spell, and this Orshadow no doubt commands powerful screening magics. Only flawless components and impeccable invocations would have even a chance of finding our foes.
The doctor looked around at each of them, and seemed to force a smile.
But let's not all look so hopeless, eh? We've a couple of names to aid us now, at least. Almighty God willing, even without a tracking spell, we will find this damned by God monster and its blessed friend.
In the corner of the workshop, Rashid shifted uneasily. His sharp features drew down in a frown.
That phrase bothers me, Doctor. How could such a creature have friends?
The doctor raised a bushy eyebrow.
You know, boy, I've heard people ask the same about Rashid Besrashid. His face is so sour, they say.
He is always making mock, even of matters of life and death,
Zamia thought, noting the doctor's oafish smile as he poked the dervish in the ribs. As if he were thinking her thoughts, Rashid frowned.
Apologies, Doctor,
the dervish said,
but there is little cause for jesting here.
The ghoul hunter smiled a frustrated smile.
Wherever on God's great earth a man tries to make light of his troubles, trust a damned by God holy man to open his mouth and put a stop to it. And here I thought this one.
He jabbed a fat finger again at Rashid.
I'd been learning to loosen up a bit.
Though Zamia could not say why, Rashid reacted as if struck.
Loosen up. May God forbid it. If anything, this is a time for redoubling virtue and vigilance. The traitorous angel's foulest servants stalk the city,
the dervish said forcefully.
May it please all merciful God to protect us all.
May it please God.
All present echoed ritually. When Zamia looked back at the doctor, he was no longer smiling. Chapter 12.
May it please God,
Dawood, son of Wajid, said, and heard his words spoken simultaneously by the others.
So now we know some of what we face, he said. What do we do about it?
For a long few moments there was nothing but silence. His words hung in the air, and the group's grim expressions reflected the enormity of the situation. Dawood scanned the faces that filled his sitting room. His wife's eyes carried the impression of having seen too much, and Abdullah's features displayed a weariness that Dawood knew was reflected in his own. The young warrior's expressions were different, though, Dawood thought. The emerald-eyed girl and clean-shaven boy were more determined than resigned. The older trio's stances were set by weary habit, but Rashid and Zamia's were set by will. Abdullah's assistant was the first to speak, and he did so heatedly.
We must warn the watchman, Doctor, or perhaps the Caliph himself. Someone in authority needs—
The ghoul hunter snorted in disbelief.
Ha! You still think this is where our energy should go, boy? After 2 years in this city, even a slave to titles such as yourself must recognize that the Caliph isn't going to believe such as us. And even if he did believe there was a threat to Damsawat, his greatest concern would be how it affects his coin purse. It is a waste of time trying to convince a selfish man to care about what lies beyond his nose. No, the Caliph will be as helpful as a hole to a pail. But I have learned that the Falcon Prince may share some of our troubles. He could... He cannot be serious. Dawood cut his friend off, putting a hand on Adula's big shoulder and wagging a finger in his face. How can one man be so wide-eyed and so damned by God cynical at the same time, brother of mine? Even if we could find Ferhad Ezhemez, linking our fates to his would bring more trouble than aid. Half this city is hunting him. And besides, there are a few good guardsmen out there, you know. Most notably their captain. He turned to Rasid, who looked desperate to kill something. Your idea is sound, Rasid. And the captain of the guard, Raun Hirad, is known to me. Indeed, Litos and I once saved his life. Tomorrow morning I will go to the Crescent Moon Palace and try to speak to him about what we've turned up. It is a vague warning I'll be bringing him, but he will be thankful for it nonetheless. It cannot hurt to have the guard aware that this threat is out there, and it just might help. Adula stroked his beard. Raun Hirad is a good man as guardsmen go. A very good man. But everyone knows he is a holdover from another era, and wields little power these days. The captain of the watch holds the real power. Still, it's not a bad idea, I suppose. If anyone in the palace is going to look past his self-interest long enough to wonder about the slaughter of poor people, it will be Captain Hirad. So, perhaps someone should speak to him. Adula turned to Rasid. Are you satisfied, boy? The dervish inclined his turbaned head in acknowledgement, then turned to Dawood.
And thank you, uncle.
Beside him, Litas stood and spoke softly.
Raun Hirad will make a good ally in this. I wish I could accompany you, my love. But the girl's healing is still incomplete. Come tomorrow morning, she'll need crimson quicksilver, and I'll need to be here with her in order to apply it. Speaking of which...
She turned her beautiful eyes to the tribeswoman.
It is about time to apply a sleeping salve. Come with me, Zamia. This is a private matter between women. Let us leave these oafs to themselves.
To Dawood, the girl seemed about to protest. No doubt she fumed at the idea of being left out of battle planning. But her head drooped and her body was clearly putting the lie to her will's stubborn resilience. With weak steps, she followed his wife out of the room. Dawood turned to Adula and Rasid and shrugged.
So, I will go alone. Litas must stay here, and the Caliph has little respect for your order, Adula.
Adula rolled his eyes.
Aye, and the feeling couldn't be more mutual. We're best off dividing tasks anyway. As for myself, he started, then looked hesitant, embarrassed even to speak his next words.
What is this? Dawood wondered. His old friend was rarely embarrassed by anything.
As for myself,
the ghoul hunter continued,
come morning I will go to the singer's quarter to speak again to the boy Faisal, whose family was slain.
So that's it. Adula was ashamed of his own weakness, afraid he was making selfish choices, anxious that Dawood would judge him harshly for it. Well, Dawood could never pass judgment on this man whom he'd been friends with for a long lifetime. But neither would he let Adula lie to himself. He smiled as he spoke.
Aye, speak again to the boy. And while you are about it, what do you know? You will be at the house of the only woman that you have ever really loved. It is funny how all-provident God arranges these things, eh?
He'd meant only to tease his friend. But Adula's expression was dark and troubled.
Miri al-Musa knows a great deal about the history of the city. She may have more information on our enemies.
At this, the dervish, who Daoud had nearly forgotten was there, chirped up.
With apologies, Doctor. I hope you will excuse me from accompanying you tomorrow, for—
For a holy man ought not to be seen traipsing about a whorehouse, eh? And ought not associate with certain types, eh?
Adula's tone spoke of the weariness of an old argument.
I grow truly tired of this boy. You cannot call a man partner and insult his friends at every turn.
The boy's tilted eyes went wide, and Daoud thought his own might have too. Adula seemed unaware of his surprising choice of words.
I have never dared to call myself your partner, Doctor. I am merely your assistant.
Adula shrugged.
You're my assistant in ghoul hunting, true. But you and that forked sword of yours are near as good at it as I was in my prime.
The boy looked profoundly embarrassed, and pink points tinted his golden cheeks.
I thank you, Doctor. But in any case, I do not ask to be excused for the reason you named. Rather, I ask to remain here and act as a guard for the women.
Now it was the boy's turn to look ashamed of himself and stammer.
The monster may return. I've failed once to protect the tribeswoman. Due to my lack of diligence, she was attacked, and if I am to—
Daoud could not listen to this. Adula teased the dervish, but essentially coddled the boy's rigid nonsense. Daoud would not. If the dervish wished to judge himself guilty on the basis of nothing, that was his business. But Daoud and his wife were being drawn back into grim matters that they'd left behind long ago. They had little choice. As foul a force as Daoud had ever sensed threatened their best friend. But he'd be damned by God if he was going to go into battle with confused warriors at his side. He wheeled on Rasid.
Do you have jackal fangs, boy?
Not so far as I can see.
So how in the name of merciful God is it your fault the girl was wounded? The life you have chosen is war, young dervish. A war against the traitorous angel. The sort of thing your order talks about in all of their oaths and traditions. Well, this is the reality. The girl ought to praise God that she's still alive. People we care for die in wars. You seem unprepared for this. And perhaps unprepared to do the duty you left the lodge for?
Rasid lowered his head, his blue turban bobbing.
You are correct, of course, uncle.
The boy's look said that each word was pulling a sword blade through his guts.
I must put the son of God's good before the candle flame of one's life. It was my fault that—
Litaz reappeared in the doorway, apparently having put the tribeswoman to bed.
What with the enemies that are after Adula? I would feel better if I could work without worrying that a ghoul pack is going to knock down the door. Let the boy stay here with me and act as a guard.
Daoud nodded.
Anything to keep you safe, beloved?
He and Litaz spent half that night lying beside each other, too anxious to sleep and not secluded enough to make love. Daoud held Litas's small hand in his, but they said little. Finally, they drifted into sleep. When he woke at dawn, he did not wake Litaz. Instead, he said silent goodbyes to her and the loudly snoring Adula, and stepped quietly out the door into the still half-dark morning. Soon the nights would be growing shorter. The Feast of Providence, the night before the shortest day of the year, was almost upon them, though he'd do no celebrating until this Orshado and the things that served him were destroyed. Daoud started walking, and soon left the scholar's quarter behind him. He breathed deeply of the early morning air, trying to drive from his body the taint he'd felt when he'd worked his scrying spell last night. The power behind that taint. There was more to this than a handful of killings, Daoud felt certain. That sort of power aimed at bigger things. For the first time since he and Litaz had seen the smoke rising from Adula's townhouse, Daoud really turned over events in his head. He was angry to have been dragged into this business. For decades, his and his wife's work had drawn them away from all that was normal and happy. Daoud's body wrecked by magic, their baby boy murdered by monsters. When they had fought and traveled beside Adula and others, the hypnotic song of responsibility had called them onto paths of danger and madness, like the snake-tailed dune maids that lured desert travelers to their doom. But they'd left that all behind. Dawood's greatest worries these past few years had to do with ministering to the poor without going broke, and with his wife's increasing desire to leave this city he had made his home. But now... He passed a shuttered storefront, then stopped walking as his chest suddenly tightened and blazed into pain. In the course of his calling, Dawood had been both stabbed and poisoned, and this felt like both at once. He began to cough and nearly collapsed from it. It was several minutes before the coughing fit passed. Standing frozen there on the street, he panted painfully, feeling his body taking on more age than was its due. The healing and scrying magics he had worked over the past day. It had been many months since he'd done such. He felt the toll with every labored breath. Loud-mouthed Adula liked to complain about his old man's aches, but he knew nothing of pain, of weakness. When Dawood worked his magic, name of God, when he simply walked down a dusty Damsawat street too fast, it felt as if God's great fingers were pinching his lungs shut. With this Orshado and his monstrous servants out there, Dawood, his wife, and his oldest friend were needed more than ever before, but he did not know how long he could last back in this life. Not for the first time, his head was filled with visions of himself as a doddering invalid who needed his wife to spoon-feed him. He tried unsuccessfully to keep his face from betraying his pain to the porters and cartmen passing by, but he saw he needn't have bothered, for the busy people of Damsawat didn't give three shits for a dying old man's agony. The only looks he received were looks of disgust. After a moment, his breathing began to return to normal, and he gave the self-centered people around him his own look of disgust.
"Perhaps Litos is right. Perhaps it is time at long last for us to leave this cold-hearted city."
He leaned heavily against a stone wall and allowed himself one deep shudder. Then he focused his soul and drew himself up. There was a task at hand, and if he was going to be there for Litos, he had to be strong. He clenched his fists and pressed on, trying not to feel the ache that was building in his back. He stepped out onto the main way, ignoring the hawker's shouts. For half a moment he toyed with the idea of hiring a sedan chair, but it was only toying. In all his years in Damsawat, Dawood had only ridden in one a handful of times. As with other things, his wife had been able to move from the Sioux way to the Abbey Sinis with more ease. When she was not with him, she often hired chairs.
"Being a rich Blue River girl prepared her for having men carry her on their backs,"
he supposed with a snort, dodging past a bow-legged pistachio seller. For an honest Red River Sioux like himself, such a way of moving through crowds was simply wrong. Not doing so on the way to the palace, though, meant a long, hard walk. At least the day promised to be a cool one. He walked for an hour and a half down broad roads before turning down Poulterer's Row, which was packed with people preparing for the Feast of Providence. Every neighborhood in the city had a chicken cellar, of course, but on Poulterer's Row, one could peruse the rare delicacies of the great master merchants. Purple partridge, sun dove, heron-stuffed swan. It was also the only place in all of Damsawat that one could buy a pickled ostrich egg from the Republic. The smells of death and feather were thick here, and Dawood was seized by a dry retching. He sat for a moment and gave a copper fells to a water-seller who poured from his skin a cup of water so welcome it made Dawood thank God aloud. After yet another hour of his sandals slapping stone and packed dirt, Dawood made it to the western gates of the Crescent Moon Palace. It had been a couple of years since he had been down this way, and he found himself newly dazzled by the building's brilliance. Rising from the great white dome on a thin spire of gold was a sculpture of a man on horseback wielding a long lance. The head of the statue was changed to resemble each new caliph. Dawood realized he'd not been to the palace since the new caliph had taken the throne of the Crescent Moon. The statue gleamed, showing the lean-featured caliph's martial prowess against God's enemies. Of course, everyone in Dam Sawa'at knew that the new caliph, like his father, had never once been in battle in his pampered life. It was the kind of hypocrisy that made Abdullah choke on his breakfast, but Dawood wasn't much bothered by it. Matters of state were about hypocrisy as much as anything else. The Sioux people understood this as a simple fact that needn't be condemned, a thing that simply was. Dawood approached the squat stone guardhouse that stood beside the gate. Calling on Raun Haddad meant getting word to him by way of a helpful watchman. Dawood did not have Abdullah's total scorn for the caliph's men, but he did know that most of them could not be truthfully described as helpful. A pair of them exited the guardhouse and walked by, wearing steel-studded leather jerkins and displaying the slim maces that were their weapon of office. They eyed Dawood as they did everyone they passed, with a vaguely menacing squint, ready, almost eager for trouble. Dawood gave these two a deferential old mannish nod and sought out the least hostile-looking watchman he could find, a lanky boy with soft eyes.
"God's peace, young man. I must get in touch with Captain Haddad immediately regarding an urgent matter."
The boy said, more politely than Dawood expected from a watchman,
"If you've got a complaint about the watch, Uncle, I'm afraid you'll need to take it to the Eastern Gate office. They'll get you an audience with the vice-captain, and in a few days, perhaps."
"Forgive me, young man, but this is not a matter that can wait. My name is Dawood, son of Wajid, and I am well known to Raun. I promise you that if you give him my name, he will want to see me right away."
The boy fixed those soft eyes on Dawood, trying to somehow spy out ill intent. He put an idle hand on his mace and scratched his nose.
"Well known, huh?"
Another long look.
"Fine.
But you'd better not be jerking me about here, uncle."
Dawood inclined his head graciously. Half an hour later, a different watchman led Dawood into a small chamber just inside the palace proper. The room was crowded with grain sacks and coils of chain, but there was a small divan in the corner. The watchman gestured to it gruffly, then left. No sooner had Dawood settled gratefully down onto the dark wood than Raun Haddad's wide frame filled the doorway. Dawood started to stand, but the captain of the guard kept him from doing so. He bent down to embrace Dawood, and they exchanged greetings. Then Raun sat beside him. The squat man had always seemed to Dawood to be cut from a block of brown stone. There was the slightest bit of gray in his thick black mustache, now, and a few tidy lines at his eyes. But he looked as hard as ever, as did the masterwork four-bladed mace at his side.
"Thank you for making time to see me, Captain."
The man scratched his club-shaped nose.
"I can always make time for a man who saved my life."
Dawood waved a dismissive hand.
"Well, my wife's tonics had as much to do with that as anything.
Besides, we were paid a good price for our work then."
"Fair enough.
So what is it you have come here to ask then, uncle?"
"If it were Litas here, she'd have planned all of the words to use here."
But that was not how he did things.
"You know some of the strange, cruel magics my wife and I once made a life of fighting,"
he said to the captain of the guard.
"I've come to you because such a threat is loose in Dam Sawa'at now."
Dawood told what little they knew of Mawawa and his master Oshado, the names, the killing they had done. As he told his tale, the captain's unsubtle face was easy for Dawood to read, shifting from annoyed disbelief to deeper consideration, to half-skeptical fear. But the captain was respectful enough not to interrupt.
"All I ask," Dawood began,
then fell silent when a richly dressed page came darting in. The page ignored Dawood and whispered something to the captain.
Dawood's old ears could only make out the words,
"He wants your turn," and Raun's protests before the boy left the room. Raun grimaced at him.
"Well, uncle, you're in luck. His Holiness asks me on occasion to bring before him whatever security matter I am dealing with at a given time. He does the same with his ministers of treasury and his undergovernors. He does it to show his active interest and to let the many arms of his government benefit from his wisdom."
There was no irony in Raun's voice, Indeed, the captain made an admirable effort to infuse the words with sincerity, but Dawood needed no magic to tell the man's true feelings.
Still, this may be for the best. Perhaps the Caliph will actually listen.
Dawood was shown not into the court of the Crescent Moon, but into a small audience chamber. Small, for the Crescent Moon Palace, of course, meant that the room was larger than Dawood's whole house, but it felt different from the publicly visible parts of the palace Dawood had seen. Here, the auras of opulence and command did not exactly diminish, but they took on a kind of intimacy. This was a place for a powerful man to pretend he was lending his ear.
Almighty God willing, he will lend it in truth.
Dawood was announced with a string of the tepid pleasantries spent on common people. The court speaker boomed in his baritone that the guests were honored to be in the presence of God's regent in the world, the defender of virtue, the most exalted of men, His Majesty, the Jabari Akh-Karari Khalif of Abbasin, and of all the Crescent Moon kingdoms. Then in unison with Raun, Dawood knelt and bowed as deeply as his weak limbs would let him. High windows displayed names of God in glass ground with emerald and opal. No noise from the palace bustle outside came through the plush brocade drapes. Off to one side, court musicians played reed pipes and two-stringed fiddles, all plated in platinum. Thick carpets of puzzle cloth, worked over and over again with a caliphic seal, muffled the sound of footfalls. At the far side of the room, just below the ceiling, a strange gold lattice box, the size of a small carriage, protruded from the wall just above head height. The Caliph's speaking box, designed so that Abbasin's ruler could hold court without enduring the profane gazes of his subjects, and within sat the defender of virtue. The small rose marble archway below the box was flanked by two cowled, black-robed men, who gave off, to Dawood's sorcerous senses, a hefty waft of magical power. Court magi. Legally, no one in Don Sawa'at works spells without the permission of the Caliph's own enchanters. In reality, a number of minor spells, invocations and ghoul raisings went on without this handful of men being able to stop them. The true purpose of the court magi was preventing the practice of any magics that might harm the Caliph or his wealth. Dawood knew little of their ways, though. They spent their time cloistered in their own minaret behind the palace proper. What went on within that thin spire of silvery stone, God alone knew. Dawood knew only the scorn with which this sort regarded the vulgar magics of a man like himself. Dawood saw vague movement behind the golden grillwork of the speaking box.
Does he always hold court from within that stifling cage?
The idea made Dawood ill, but it lent a sudden sense to some of the Caliph's more ruthless acts. Ruling from such confinement could make a man mad.
This is what Adula and that mad falcon prince he admires so much do not see, that everyone pays a price for the way the world works, even the so-called powerful. That power is a trap as well.
The effects of magery on his own body had long given Dawood a keen, not to say brutal, awareness of such facts. The sun shone through the jewel-tinted windows, and the Caliph's box seemed to be wreathed in rainbows. Cage or no, for a moment Dawood almost believed the man was God's regent in the world. The court musician stopped playing. A long-faced man dressed in rich silks, clearly a senior minister of some sort, asked Raun what matters of guardsmanship he brought before the court. Only then did Raun seem to recognize the wispiness of what he knew. His face flashed confusion, but he spoke steadily.
This man beside me, O defender of virtue, is Dawood, son of Wajid. He is a true servant of God who once saved my life when a poisoner tried to kill me to stop me from serving your father. More to the point, your majesty. This man has spent many years hunting the minions of the traitorous angel. He was in the midst of telling me about a potential threat to your city, majesty, when you summoned me here. It is perhaps best if I let him tell the court.
O most exalted of men, I am here to ask you,
Dawood began, trying in his rough Red River way to use court phrasings the way Litas had taught him long ago. The long-faced minister's scandalized eyes bulged.
You are neither minister nor captain. You must speak to the court, sir. You shall not speak directly to His Majesty.
He'd miscalculated. Despite her having forsaken her family, Litas was a pasha's niece. She had taught him an etiquette appropriate to a man of much higher station. She'd warned him of this when she'd tried to train him years ago, of course. Why did he only ever seem to recall his wife's warnings in the moments after failing to heed them? Within the golden box, Dawood heard a man clear his throat. The court fell completely silent.
He is a street man, Jaudi. He cannot be expected to speak like a man of our court. Continue, O venerable subject, and know that we hear you.
Perhaps he is not so bad as the Sidi's wagging tongues claim. Dawood didn't fool himself that the Caliph had anything but scorn for him. But showing polite respect to the scorned was as sure a measure of character as Dawood knew. He dragged a labored breath deep into his chest and chose his words carefully.
I am as honored as a man can be to be permitted to speak before you, O defender of virtue. As Captain Hedart says, I have made a life of fighting the influence of the traitorous angel. The captain can tell your majesty that I am no madman. Of the lives I have saved.
He paused, searching for his next words. The long-faced minister broke in here.
I hope, sir, you have not come into the radiant presence of the defender of virtue merely to boast of your back-alley accomplishments. His majesty's every moment is worth your weight in gold. To waste them is a crime worse than murder. Speak, sir, if you've something of import to say.
Of course, your eminence.
The man looked slightly mollified. Good, he'd got that title right. No doubt it pleased these men to see a common man like Dawood try nobly to match their ways of speaking, so long as he wasn't too good at it. Not that they needed to worry about that.
I will come to the point. A strange threat is looming over your majesty's city. One as learned as his majesty knows better than I that before the great flood of fire, the Kem ruled this land. We know that God punished them, and that they were wiped from the slate of the world. Some things from their age, a bit of statuary here, a buried wall there, remain, perhaps left to us by God as a warning against wickedness. Yet other foul things from God's scored Kim have survived, O defender of virtue, or at least the influence of their cruel magics has.
You speak of the dead gods?
One of the court magi asked scornfully, the first words that either of the black-robed figures had spoken. The man's voice said that he did not take the threat seriously. The memory of the tainted soul he'd touched with his scrying spell filled Dawood. He had to make these men take him seriously.
Yes, your eminence, one of the dead gods of Kem, or the potent shadow of their power, has taken hold of a man who was already a vicious killer. It has given him power and freed him from fear of swords and fire. Their magic has mingled with this dark soul, and the creature born of this union calls itself Mawawa, the Manjackal. This thing is loose in His Majesty's city. It has killed dozens already. What's worse, its master is...
Why, sirrah, have we of the court heard nothing of these murders, then?
The long-faced minister interrupted scornfully.
Where is...
The second court magus silenced the man with an upraised hand. So that's how the whipping order goes here.
This man's ramblings are not for the blessed ears of the defender of the faithful. At most, perhaps one of his fellow streetmen with a few trick spells has murdered a few other streetmen.
That black-cowled head turned to Dawood.
The court commands you to return to your home. Speak to the first watchman you see there, and he will address this matter in the manner already ordained by His Majesty's law.
Dawood dared to speak when he should have kept his mouth shut. When would he again have the ear of the Caliph?
10,000 apologies, your eminence, but this Mawawa and its master, he is called Orshodo, though we know little more than that, are no streetmen. They will kill again,
And they will not be satisfied with killing tribesmen and street people. Powerful villains aim their arrows at the powerful. The danger to the palace is...
Too late, Dawood fell silent, realizing his mistake.
Idiot, tossing threats at the most powerful man in the world.
The golden grill of the opulent box swung up with a sudden bang. Dawood felt his old heart seize up at the sound.
Please, God, do not let him be angry with me. I want to see my wife again.
The might such a man commanded. This was what Adula did not understand, that all the scorn in the world could not protect one from such power. Dawood still could not see within the box. There was a more than natural darkness at work there, unless he missed Ismagus's guess. But a thin, pale hand shot out from the shadows. The caliph jabbed two fingers, ablaze with huge rubies, out angrily at Dawood. Courtiers and servants alike gasped and shot their eyes downward.
After Captain Haddad's introduction, we were inclined to be kind toward our venerable subject. But after this nonsense, we are displeased. You should thank Almighty God that we have not had you thrown in the jail.
Dawood had faced death 100 times. He had not survived to die at an annoyed ruler's whim. He deepened his bow, punishing his old limbs and holding in his grunts.
God grant you 10,000 blessings for your mercy, Majesty.
God's regent in the world must have sensed some insincerity in Dawood's words, for the caliph broke from the formalized language of the court sovereign.
Shut up, you old fool! You come in here making threats to our city and our palace? You tell nail-biting tales of a phantom killer as if we were some merchant's boy and you were our fright-mongering nurse? And no doubt this threat shadow would lift from our court if only we were to buy some trinket or spell from you, eh?
Bah! My father would have had your head, old man!
Your father would have pulled his head out from his backside and taken such a threat seriously.
Dawood kept the words to himself. Beside Dawood, Ra'oon bowed deeply.
I beg your majesty to forgive this old fool for bothering you. I swear by God that Dawood, son of Wajid, would never dream of offering your eminence any harm or threat of harm. His feeble old Su-mine is rattled with imaginary threats, is all.
The caliph was silent for a moment, and the court seemed to hold its breath. When he spoke again, his intonation was unabashedly rude.
Bah! Captain, we should have you flogged for wasting our sacred moments with this idiocy. Name of God, you are both fortunate that we are known for our mercy. If we are ever made to look at your ugly face again, Magus, we shall part your head from your shoulders. The same goes for you, Captain. If you do not bring matters of real urgency to us next time we ask. Now be gone, both of you.